Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 14, and we're recording it on February 15th, 2018. The podcast where we geek out about all the photo news that is worthy of geeking out about. And this week we have a ton of it. Joined with me, I'm your co-host, Don Komarechka, and joined with me this week is a colleague and a friend and a student of mine. We have interacted in many ways over the past years. You've been a student of mine in the Arcanum, and we have both kind of co-led some workshops together. This is Brian Weiss of Day Tripper Photo. Brian, how are you doing today?
Fantastic. Don, thank you very much for asking me to do this. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I think so. And I figured, you know, having somebody that I have a personal, like a face-to-face relationship with, makes for a great rapport for conversation. But you know, we also kind of go back as, let's say, kindred spirits. We both work, you currently work, in the retail camera industry. And you were working just before this recording as well. So maybe I can pick your brain on that for a minute.
Definitely.
Because I used to work for Black's Photography, which is no more. It was a wonderful Canadian retailer of cameras. And I think they put a lot of their effort into printing. And when the print industry started to kind of, you know, taper off with the digital workflow and everything else, the writing was on the wall. They were bought by Telus and tried to bring it back, but it just really didn't connect. So I left before they kind of closed up shop, because my photographic career was deeming my free time non-existent anymore. But I know you have a really fun balance between what you do at Day Tripper Photo and what you do at Henry's, which is probably the best Canadian camera store chain right now. So why don't you fill me in on how you make that balance work?
It was actually interesting. It started off years ago when I saw people leaving the Henry's School of Imaging classroom, scratching their heads and being like, I love the class I took. I love Martin. I love the instructor, but I'm not retaining information. So I thought, well, the only way you're going to retain the information is if you do it. So I thought, let's get people doing day trips. So I go from selling cameras for 2 years at that point to talking to the owner of Henry's, who gave me full permission to do it. Thank you very much for that. And ever since then, I've been just showing people how to use their gear hands-on on day trips. But, you know, it's interesting. Like you say, one minute I'm selling cameras in the store, and the next minute I'm out in the field teaching people how to use them. And there has to be this gray area in between where there has to be trust built, because I'm an educator, but I can't be a salesman. You know what I mean? Like, there's that whole...
Oh, yeah. You know, and I remember when I was at Black's, that whenever we would sell a camera, somebody would get a complimentary one-on-one, one-hour lesson if they chose to register for it. And that's how we did our training. And I was representative as being good at it and wanting to do it. So when I would walk in for...
But that's helped where you're at today.
Absolutely.
I mean, a lot of what you've done there has trained you.
There's no question. But I kind of got in trouble by the higher ups. My manager knew that I was, you know, booked for a four-hour shift, and I had four back-to-back camera lessons. And so I made zero sales. And so my manager had to stick up for me, especially when, you know, the camera lessons were expected to have add-on purchases like a UV filter or an extra battery or whatever this stuff is. And here I am special ordering a lens hood for this particular camera, because I thought that was a much better buy than a UV filter. But it's a custom order. The profit margins aren't there. It takes time. Somebody on the back end has to go, like one of the purchasing people, and fill out this order. They got kind of annoyed with me after a little while.
There has to be a balance. There has to be a fine line between being a salesperson and then also satisfying your client. I mean, that's what I love about Day Tripper. And, you know, I started the Newmarket Camera Club with Ross, and I've always put myself into a position of somebody has to, well, I'm there to be trusted. I'm there to educate and show you how to use it. But all of the sales experience I had beforehand came in extremely handy for planting seeds and for, you know, letting customers know this is the right approach or this is the wrong approach. And of course, like you just said, I've worked with people in Henry's who were the same as you were saying, where they know this is the exact product that works for you, but it doesn't happen to be in the store and it might not make us as much money, but that's what we're going to the effort to do.
So the topics du jour that we have are near and dear to my heart. You know, the reason why I mentioned your camera retail experience is because when you have somebody walking and they want a new camera, they don't know really what a new camera is because they might have been out of the market for a decade. Maybe they've never bought a new camera because they're used to their cell phone, or maybe they just, they're happy with what they have and they don't know what exists on the market today. And, you know, it's evolving so quickly. It's changing so drastically. And I have in my hands here a new camera that was just announced a few days ago. And this is from Panasonic. It is their GX9. And so this is our leading story here because, you know, the mirrorless format is something that I have been shy on in the last little while because I love my big, heavy 1DX Mark II. It is a beauty of a camera. It performs so eloquently. But this little camera that when I was contacting Panasonic, I mean, I have to state, I'm not sponsored by them. They did not give me this camera for free to keep. I'm just testing it for a little while. But I got my hands on it and I figured, well, let me try to do some of the things that I do with the big guns with this little itsy bitsy camera.
How'd that work out for you?
Actually, quite remarkably well. I did some freezing soap bubble imagery with it. They gave me the Panasonic Leica 45mm macro lens, which is a beautiful piece of glass. I mean, it doesn't matter what camera you attach it to. It performs exceptionally well. But this is a 20-megapixel, very small camera body. We are recording this on video. We're going to try that again and see how that works. But this is a tiny little camera compared to what I'm used to anyhow. And it is awesome. I mean, I haven't tested it at the very high ISOs. I haven't tested it with a variety of lenses. But one of the things that I liked about this format, and I tested the GH5 a while ago when it was first released, it's that when you're dealing with macro photography, something that I am, you know, it is in my heart, it is in my blood, one-to-one life size on this camera is the equivalent of two-to-one life size on my full-frame camera because it's a two-to-one crop factor. And while that enhances your telephoto reach in some cases, it also doubles your magnification when it comes to macro photography. So you can get from infinity focus to what I consider two-to-one macro in this kind of combination. And so that lends itself to all sorts of possibilities. I've got some extension tubes for this as well. We haven't had any snow. I'm hoping to do some snowflake photography with it and some water droplet refraction photography and just kind of run it through its paces.
For all of the stuff you've mentioned, you're all shooting at very low ISO, right?
Relatively, maybe. I did some ISO 1600, ISO 3200 stuff in the last little while. I haven't had a chance to go through and edit it, but on the back of the camera, it looked decent enough. One of the problems, and I'm kind of kicking myself for this, is I have the camera early. There's no RAW support. I can't I can't plug that those RAW files into Lightroom or any RAW processor right now and use them. So, I mean, I've got...
Would the camera come with that for you? Would the camera come with like a RAW converter?
You know, I didn't look in the box. Maybe there is something there. But at least Lightroom and the Adobe software doesn't have anything. So I was shooting JPEG plus RAW for the last little while, and it was keeping up really quite nicely with a memory card that I have, thanks to you, by the way. But the results, and there will be two images in the show notes of some freezing soap bubbles that were done at relatively lower ISOs, I think ISO 400, and they perform really well. The camera is not perfect, but it's great.
Yeah, those are phenomenal. Panasonic and Olympus came out with the mirrorless format pretty much. They were the first to have a mirrorless camera, maybe about two model years before the next people like Sony and Nikon and the other guys started coming out with them. So they've got their stuff down. Their technology is fantastic. The post focus, all the cool things that it does. But sensor size has a real impact on higher ISO.
Of course, because you're collecting less light.
Exactly. And when you notice is, and you, I'd love to hear your opinion when you do your final analysis of the images, you're going to notice that rather than having your high ISO look like dots, it's going to look like little brush strokes, like almost like a watercolor.
Yeah, well, I mean, that has to do something with the compression of the files. It has to do with the noise reduction that's applied to the files. We're not talking about the raw data. We're talking about an embedded JPEG or a just a finalized JPEG from the camera itself. I did notice that I did some tests using, I think it was ISO 200, with ultraviolet fluorescence. And I have this beautiful image. You know what? This is one where I said to myself, I have to wait until I have the raw data, because the JPEG data with 8 bits per channel just does not give me enough leeway to give me the color fortitude that I'm after. And the white balance for that kind of imagery is always going to be wrong, because there's no frame of reference for accuracy on that. And right. I can change that after the fact with the raw file. But I looked at this image, which I had done as a very long exposure, a 30-second exposure, and it did its long exposure noise reduction thing. It looked good. And I have traditionally had a hard time dealing with long exposure noise on cameras. And I'm very happy with this. It will not replace my 1DX Mark II. I don't think by
any
stretch.
It's not built to be that, though.
It's not built to be that. But if I wanted to have another camera in my camera bag that could shoot behind the scenes footage, which right now I do with my phone, and I don't think that's good enough. This thing shoots 4K video, albeit not at the highest bit rates, but it's still good enough for that behind the scenes, that second camera, or a camera that I want to just pull out and shoot family events, take traveling with me, something where the big guns aren't needed. I think this is going to be a really viable alternative for me. And the GH5 that I had tested before really wet my whistle for this. I was ready
to... It's a beautiful camera, but it's kind of chunkier.
It's chunkier. And so if I wanted to just throw something in my pocket or in a very small, you know, bag just by my side, or say, you know, hey, sweetheart, this fits in your purse, and have it carry on that way, I think that this is great. Now, we should state, this camera, the GX9, is not a direct successor to the GX8. It's more of a mix between the GX85 in size and format with the feature set of the GX8. And there's some caveats to that. You don't have weather sealing, although I've used the Canon MPE 65mm lens for all of my snowflake photography outside for about a decade, and it does not have weather sealing, and it has not died on me yet. Maybe I'm testing my luck with that, but
no, they do that. I mean, they're meant to work in those environments. They're just not going to say that, oh, get these things wet, right?
I would not use a camera like this in a torrential downpour. I mean, it's not going to be the kit for that. So it is a fair weather camera to some degrees. It's not rated for sub-zero temperatures. Neither is my 1DX Mark II. Mm-hmm. And I've used both of these in very cold temps, and it's been fine. So
have you ever used the GX7?
I have not used the GX7, but in Japan, they mark the GX8 as the GX7 Mark II, and they're marking this one as the GX7 Mark III, because the GX7 has such a high regard, at least in Japan, that became a point of reference to forward with.
I've used that camera a lot. I used it with the 15mm f1.7 Leica. And I brought that to, Christmas parties and other things like that. And it's such a fun camera to use. And I agree with you, the form factor and the functions of what it can do, it's a great camera to keep on you. I love the Panasonic lineup top to bottom.
There have been some duds, I'm sure, along the way. But it's funny because you see all the tech that they put into this, the five-way image stabilization, and it's not as good as some of the other cameras. I noticed even that the 4K video doesn't use the full sensor; they use some proximity to that, but it's still good enough.
And now, do you shoot 4K, or are you one of those guys that would rather just shoot high quality 1080 and not have to worry about, you know, the upload time and the edit time and the workflow time of shooting 4K?
Well, if I know to, most if of I people I know like down. If I convert it down to 1080p, the time is minimal for me. I've got a powerful computer. I can handle that. But at the same time, I'm thinking to myself, I got to get the best if I need to zoom in on something, if I'm maybe not close enough, or if I'm going to push the editing. This is why some people do medium format photography for portraiture, because that gives them more pixels to edit with, even though they're going to scale it down to something smaller. It kind of hides some of the foibles in the editing process. Mm-hmm. So if you're really pushing pixels in editing, and this camera does not have a whole feature set for video, more pixels can hide some of the crunchiness. And then if you scale it down to 720 or 1080, it kind of hides, for lack of a better word, and I guess the editing that you might
if you want to do a screen capture, you're capturing an 8-megapixel still from the video.
True. So yeah. So
that's helpful too, right?
It is. But I want to say that this camera I've only had for maybe about 2 weeks right now, and I've only used it about 3 or 4 times. But I am tempted to say to the Panasonic Canada rep, how much would it cost for me to just not give this back?
That's saying a lot. That is really saying a lot.
And not to say that it's going to replace my main gear. This would be a secondary camera because, you know, Canon has not come out with a mirrorless full frame, and their mirrorless APS-C format, it's okay. It's fine. It does the job. I find like that M5. Panasonic, Olympus, and Sony, of course, they are really pushing the envelope here and creating something that is worthy of my attention, I think.
I do have a love for the M5 Canon mirrorless.
Oh, and as you should. I'm not saying that it's a bad camera by any means. And, you know, I have taken some bad pictures with this GX9. I can guarantee you that most of them aren't good. Mm-hmm. But if you have the skill as a photographer and you know your technique that has been developed by any means in the film era, the digital, and you know your stuff, you can pick up this camera and it can work for you.
And even if you don't, intelligent auto is awesome.
Well, if you're just learning, yeah, if you're trying to get your head around exactly what it is a photograph should be, and you're working through, you know, composition and lines and shapes and where the edges of the frame should connect to make something beautiful or at least visually navigatable, then, you know, having a camera that lets the automatic system take over to a degree, you know, I mean, to figure out where the lines and those shapes will occur, I think it's a valuable thing. But
well, keep in mind too, the user of a Panasonic mirrorless camera in general isn't necessarily yourself or Peter McKinnon or all these people with these extremely high expectations. They're generally the people who want a compact travel camera. They're going away to Europe for the week. They want to have a good quality camera that they can just put it in auto and let it rip. And I think that's where Panasonic is, let's say at its strongest, is that their intelligent auto will see a face and go to portrait. Moving close, it switches to macro. It's extremely intuitive in their menu structure, very easy to follow. And I think that's Panasonic's strong point. It always has been. Second to that would be the fact that you can use Leica lenses, which are extremely good quality lenses, and their sensor and their processing technology is improving every year. It's just a well-rounded kit for yourself or for a first-time user.
All right. Well, let's wind this off with an image. This is one of the images that I shot with this particular camera, and anybody listening to the audio won't be able to see this.
But, Don, you make me so angry.
But this is, I mean, I've edited this photograph. It's a freezing soap bubble sitting on top of a Gerbera daisy, and it is in the show notes for anybody listening to this. I am very happy with this image. Oh, yeah. I'm very happy with the quality and the performance of the camera, and I'm happy with my ability to capture something like this.
I would be very happy just to blow a soap bubble that doesn't pop, but that's just me.
the point of this this idea is, yes, could I shoot this with my higher end gear? Absolutely. Would I get better results? For a subject like this, I think the results would be comparable, very similar at the end of the day. So could this replace my main camera in certain cases? It might be able to. It won't, because I'm not going to give up that 1DX Mark II come hell or high water. But seeing the results, I'm sold on it. I'm really happy with this.
And you hit the nail on the head though, Don, when you said for this kind of photo. I think that's what somebody has to do when they're looking to buy a camera. Is this camera going to do my style of photography the way I need it to? And I think for low ISO and for the stuff you're doing with it, I highly doubt you would see a huge difference. But again, how does this perform when you start getting into focus stacking? And is this a stacked image?
You cannot stack a freezing soap bubble because it will be different from one frame to the next.
Ah, yes, because it's growing and it's changing.
It will freeze solid in about 5 seconds flat.
Got it.
You know, even at 10 frames per second or whatever it is that you're shooting at, one frame will never match the next.
And are you using flash for this, or are you using your high power LED flashlight?
There is a bright flashlight stuck in behind.
Got it.
You can kind of see a bit of a catch light on the top of the bubble. It's just out of frame on the top, but a fair ways away behind that it's going to illuminate everything that you see in the photograph. And it's, I mean, it's an 1800 lumen flashlight that I kind of refocus onto this one particular spot. But you know, this is within the realm of possibility of anybody wanting to explore macro photography. Mm-hmm. Would I have gotten this shot having bought this camera as my first piece of kit? Not a chance. But all of the skills that I have learned translate into using this gear effectively. And I think that's sort of the message there.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Enough about this. I don't want to opine on too much about this particular camera because there is still testing to do. And I will discover that it is not perfect. But at the same time, I have to come up to the idea that that my gear, as good as it is, might not be the best gear possible because I'm not going to take this this 1DX kit to Bulgaria again with me when my wife and I go off on vacation with our daughter later this summer. A smaller camera is going to be what's accompanying.
And I think sticking with the Panasonic, just the one last point I want to make is they have more than 60 lenses you can choose from between Olympus and Panasonic. You can get the field of view and the perspective you want with this infrastructure, where Canon, for example, they have like five, or Sony has maybe a dozen. Like these manufacturers are still catching up to what Panasonic and Olympus have already built. So,
well, and the third party manufacturers as well. Let's not Sigma, forget this. Like Voigtlander and Sigma and a lot of other names, Yongzi Optics, etc. They'll make lenses that will fit onto this mount. They'll adapt it to the Micro Four Thirds, whatever. And you have a very, you know, Zeiss even, I think, has some lenses for this particular system. You have a lot of options.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, cool. Perfect. So the next story that we have to talk about gets really geeky to an atomic level. So the story that I found in a variety of places, first on Petapixel, and then I followed through and I found an article on Science Alert that had a few more details about what was being done here. But a photographer has photographed an atom. Let that sink in for a minute. An atom. How do you photograph a single atom? Photograph using light. Okay, I mean, there are people that use electron microscopy, electron microscopes at a very small scale, and even that has a hard time isolating a single atom of something or a molecule of something. So using light to image an atom. This struck me as a little bit unusual at first. Did you get a chance to read this article, Brian?
I haven't gone through the entire thing because I really want to just hear your breakdown of it. And plus, I'm curious, you've shot some pretty small things. When you shoot a snowflake in comparison to an atom, like the smallest snowflake you've shot, I mean, we're talking still hundreds of times difference in size.
Well, exactly. So let's put this into perspective. The size of a strontium atom, which is what was photographed here, is really small. A strontium atom is 255 picometers in reality. You know, if we talk about other atoms, oxygen is 152 picometers, lead is 202. So strontium is a really heavy atom. You know, it's a big one, but it's still really, really small. So a picometer is 1 million nanometers, if that that puts it into any perspective. And a nanometer, I think, is 1/1000th of a millimeter, if I'm not mistaken.
And I think the old VHS video heads were the biggest 19 nanometers or something like that.
Right.
Video
so heads. We're getting real small.
Yeah, real small.
I mean, we are literally on an atomic level. So this photograph has two cylindrical metal rods that are electrified in complete vacuum and chilled in order to make this thing as quiet as possible, because you know any temperature will excite and move an atom around. And I think that might be part of the crux of this here, because I saw the gear being used was a Canon camera with a 50 millimeter lens and some extension tubes, and I'm thinking that's not a lot at all to photograph an atom anyhow. So I did some number crunching. I have a sheet here of maths, and I did some maths here. The idea is that on one of these articles, it said that the distance between the two metal rods is about 2 millimeters. And so that gives me a perfect frame of reference, because now I can start to measure things. If I know that that's 2 millimeters, and on the Petapixel article, it's got a much wider field of view. which equates to knowing that this was, I think, a 5D Mark II. So that's a full frame camera sensor, 36 millimeters across. And the exact distances I figured out to be a 0.7x magnification, not even full one-to-one life size that a macro lens can get to. So how are we imaging an atom at this level of magnification? If you actually measure the atom itself on this image, which I've done, of course.
Of course.
It measures 7 pixels across. And the 2 millimeters measures 202 pixels across. So that means that the atom appears to be 0.066 millimeters or 66 microns, which would be 66 million picometers.
Okay.
Now, I know it's 255 picometers. So it is appearing almost 26,000 times larger than it actually is in this photograph.
It's just to get your mind around that is ridiculous.
So now why? Why is it appearing 26,000 times larger than it actually is? Well, maybe it's not static, because in these articles, it mentions that it was a long exposure. And so having a long exposure means that if that atom is excited and moving around a little bit, it might create some motion and create a bigger circle of movement. Maybe the electric field that it was in was not completely perfectly stable over this longer period of time to keep it static and still. So it's been moving around. It has to have been. Or there is some flare coming off of the blue-violet laser that is illuminating it. But regardless, it is a photograph of a single atom. We're trusting that it is just one and not a cluster of them. But it is deceptive in the sense that it is not appearing as its actual size. It is appearing far, far larger than it is in reality. And I don't think that was necessarily reported. So I did the numbers. The numbers say that it is 26,000 times larger than a strontium atom would normally appear. And does it make it less impressive? I don't know. It's still a really cool photograph. It's one that I have photographed things of much higher magnifications and potentially larger detail. And you can do that optically. So what if you were to fix a 20, 50, 100 times microscope objective against this thing? How much more detail would you see? Would you see its movement? Would you see something that reveals the actual atom compared to what we're seeing? Because it's a dot suspended
between two probes, basically.
It's
like its own little environment, and so it's just kind of hovering around in there.
But it is cool science, regardless. Cool science. I mean, I can't make this in terms of a subject worthy of photographing. I could arguably make a better photo of it, but this is where science and photography intersect.
And this is literally won a science photo contest. So the whole point of making this photo was for a photo contest?
I don't know, but I've entered science photo contests before and I've never won. I've not even placed an honorable mention. The Nikon, that's not true. The Royal Photography Society, they did publish one of my images in the UK, but the Nikon Small World Contest, which is open to anybody from any camera manufacturer, I've submitted my snowflake photographs to them on numerous occasions, and I have not ever won even an honorable mention.
They probably can't get what's actually going on. It's a little beyond.
No, they get it. But I think the criteria is I'm not using a microscope objective. I'm using the Canon MPE 65 millimeter lens with extension tubes and extra optics to get up to about a 12:1 magnification, which is surely in the realm of microscopy, but I'm not using a microscope. And that's the crux of it. I think I'm disqualified because of that. But anyhow, I'll get off my soapbox about it.
Change the rules, Don. Because there is more fun. Change the rules.
Exactly. But there is new fun science in on a different scale. I'm sure you're familiar, Brian, with the New Horizons space probe that flew past Pluto a few years ago. Well, not even a few years ago, fairly recently. And it was a testament of the awesomeness of mankind and science to get some really killer photos of Pluto. And to me, I thought, wow, mission accomplished. Let it go off into the darkness. Well, there are still things to image off in the darkness. And I didn't realize this, that the New Horizons space probe is still active, and it will still be active for many years to come. Did you get a chance to look at some of the images that it has taken?
This is the kind of thing that is right up my alley. In high school, I started the astronomy program, the astronomy club, I guess you could say. We ground our own glass to make our own telescopes back in the day, which my mother threw in the garbage when I was back in Canada. Anyway, Anyway, I don't want to rehash that. I love the astro side of photography. Never got into it because I was living in Vermont at the time and it wasn't digital then. We're talking like 84 through 89. So, you know, it was a different time. But looking at these images, and I mentioned to you when you mentioned this to me earlier, that it reminds me of the probes that landed on Mars. And they roamed around, the rovers, and they were taking all these pictures for long after they expected these things to run for.
Well, I mean, what was it? It was Spirit and Opportunity were the two first ones. And then Curiosity came later. But I remember Spirit and Opportunity, they landed, or at least one of them did. I can't remember if it was concurrent at something like 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. And I stayed up for it. You know, I was in high school at the time. And there was a coupon in the newspaper for a free breakfast from Burger King starting at 4 a.m. So here I am on the night.
For the landing.
I either before or just after, but I was up for this and I was checking my phone for updates and things at the time. And so here I am walking to Burger King at 4 a.m. for my pancake breakfast for free. And and I walk in, met with like some hooligans and drunks. And I mean, as you would expect at Burger King at 4 a.m. And I asked for my pancakes and they wouldn't give them to me because they said that breakfast wouldn't start until 6. And I showed them the coupon that said very specifically 4 a.m. And I put up a fuss about that. And all of the drunk people around me, they rallied behind me. and they insisted that I get my pancakes at 4 a.m. during the time window of the Spirit and Opportunity rovers landing. So it's there's my aside.
Funny how you remember moments. That's awesome.
Well, because I committed so much of that night to memory because it was really important for me. And so anyhow.
I just followed along on JPL Labs' website. Checked all the photos.
I think Opportunity is still going. Right? Like it's still active right now after the mission was supposed to be 30 days and it has been almost a decade or maybe it's more than a decade now. I haven't looked at the timeline. My memory doesn't remember the days between then and now, but
actually 13 years now. It was
13 years.
12 years in January 2016. So 17, 18, that's 14 years. It's still going.
And of course, Voyager 2 is still in contact. You know, we can ping it and it responds. Although it's not really doing a whole lot out beyond the heliosphere, I think it's what it's called, where the solar winds end. But that is where the New Horizons probe will be. I think it said in 2038, it will pass beyond the heliosphere. And it will still be talkative to us. Maybe it could do some meaningful research, although I don't think that they put any special instruments to document that specifically, but it will be able to talk to us and to think about what we are creating as mankind. I mean, we had the Falcon 9 launch, the Falcon 9 Heavy recently, and we have an electric car in solar orbit. We have the New Horizons space probe, which is out creating imagery in the Kuiper belt. Is that how it's pronounced? Why would you put an I next to a U? Because English does not define that in any meaningful way.
You know what impresses me is the speed that it's traveling and how far it is away. When it sends the photo, it took, what'd they say, approximately 5 hours and 39 minutes for their signal to reach Earth, even traveling at over 186,000 miles per second.
Light speed.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Love this stuff.
And so it is imaging the outer reaches of the Kuiper belt, however you want to say it. But it is creating photographs that are dim and, you know, not terribly interesting from an art perspective. But to say that those objects out there have been imaged now because we can never do it any other way, I think that's really valuable. And it's a feather in our cap as a species, as a society. And all the more power to this particular space probe that I thought was done. I would love to talk to one of the engineers that designed the cameras on board this this probe, because a lot of it is simple math. I mean, if you can figure out how to get this thing to fly by Pluto from trajectories and what have you, I think it's pretty simple to figure out with math where to point the camera and what the exposure is going to be in that scenario to get a good shot. I mean, you've got a lot of time to calculate this.
Well, I believe I actually spoke to one of these guys and they told me that it's a Panasonic engine.
But still, you know, it's fun to think that, okay, astronomy is all about math. It's all about calculations. It's all about being accurate about things. And so when you boil that into photography, it's like, okay, well, the camera has to be pointed exactly here at exactly this second with exactly this exposure, because we know 100% where we are and everything around us. As photographers, if I could speak, as photographers, we do not have that kind of accuracy. We are far more creative and less analytical. But to see the results of that analytical attitude in the outer reaches of our solar system, I think it's wonderful. I'm very happy about it.
It's really interesting. You don't think of it that way. As a photographer, these aren't photographers sending a camera up to make beautiful images. These are just capturing light and trying to see what's available. It's a different way of thinking, isn't it?
Like the atom photo. I mean, or whenever you're getting to the extremes that science is required to create a subject or to image a subject, the aesthetics of art don't play into it. It's just the sheer science and the value of the image being science. So that is where we are. We are pushing limits and we're having fun doing it.
And that's what it's all about. I mean, it's like you mentioned the Falcon Heavy.
Yeah, Falcon 9 Heavy.
The way that they synchronized their landing of the two main fuel things was as they came back, the rockets, as they came back to Earth.
It was
the synchronization. It was like unbelievable that they could do this. I mean, because basically they detached from the ship and then they made their way back, and it showed the whole trip as they made their way
cosmic
back to the landing pads.
Ballet.
Beautiful stuff. And yet, I don't know, it's just, they could do that, and then they make so many other mistakes in so many other ways, and it's such a sensitive thing.
Nothing
and
is perfect.
They lost
in our
one
world.
Of the rockets, and then of course it didn't. The apparently the car that's being launched isn't actually going to make it to Mars now. It's off on some completely different trajectory because they left the engines on for a little too long. They can land these things perfectly, and yet they miss the trajectory off to Mars.
Aim for the moon, you end up in the stars, or in this case, Mars, and you're still off target. But hey, you know what?
It's interesting to watch.
In 100, 1,000 years, mankind will recover that that car and put it in a museum orbiting Mars.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Wouldn't that be cool?
Well, we won't be around to see it, so.
We won't be around to see it, but we will be around to see the next lens I'm drooling after from Sigma. And this is something that Nikon users have had for a long time, a 14 to 24 millimeter f2.8 wide angle zoom. And as a Canon shooter, I have been very envious, and now I am not. Because this lens really covers that holy trinity that Nikon users have had. And Canon, well, we had the 11 to 24, but it was only f4 and it didn't really suit the needs of astrophotographers. And I used it for a while. I didn't even like it at the 11 millimeter for interior photos. It just stretched things way too much.
And Tamron had the 15 to 30, which I did use, and it was not even close to the 14 to 24. No offense, Tamron, but I can't. It's just too stretched. The edges were too soft. That 1424 is a gem. I really am curious. You know that I get Sigma lenses for the day trips that I run. So we're out in Algonquin Park and people are using all the Sigma glass. You've been on that trip. You've seen the briefcases of lenses. So I'm really anxious to get this in my kit and to play with it. Because if it's close to the Nikon version and yet you can save $1,000 and still get the sharpness and the 7-year warranty and the service of Gentech, What a great option this will be.
Of course, Gentech is the Canadian handler of Sigma here. But, you know, you look at this camera, or this lens rather, and I think if I were to put that on my high-end camera, the 1DX Mark II, which has very good low-light performance, to photograph the night sky. This is the lens, unless I'm using a fisheye lens. Now, here's the problem. I don't mind distortion for a lot of the work that I create. You know, if I'm using a fisheye lens, it's 180 degree field of view. I have most of the night sky in my frame if I have the horizon near the bottom.
And you also know how to compose with a lens like that. You line it up on the edge and you let it wrap around and you use the curve as telling the story, which a lot of people don't get.
Or you can correct for that to some degree, and you can use the warp tool in Photoshop to nudge that a little bit back down to normal without affecting the rest of the sky. So that's an f2.8 lens as well, and it has a wider field of view, even though it's 15 millimeters versus 14 millimeters on the wide end of that lens. So will I buy one? I don't know.
Yeah, try it first.
But I'm going to try it. And if you've got connections, Brian, I am going to pull some strings here and try to make that work.
The next time I have the kit and this is in there, I will let you know.
All right. I would appreciate that.
But you're right. I mean, night sky shots, what's that classic setting for the Milky Way photo? F2.8, 30 seconds, 3200 ISO-ish?
Well, and the 3200 ISO is becoming something that you can push a little bit further, 4,000, 5,000, depending on your camera. Mm-hmm. And the 30-second mark, I mean, that has to, I love that with a fisheye lens. If I were using a 14 millimeter rectilinear, you know, adjusted to have no distortion lens, I might not be able to do that there. So I might bring it down to 20 or 15 seconds, you know, accommodating that with the ISO being pushed up a little bit. But no matter how you slice it, this is a valuable tool.
It opens up new tools for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think we have a price on it yet, though.
It doesn't say anything in the story here, but I think it's interesting that they say the new ultra-wide zoom is designed for 50 megapixel plus cameras.
Okay, so that doesn't mean that it will work well with a 50 megapixel plus camera.
It's designed for 50 megapixel plus cameras.
50? Oh, I heard you say 15.
No, 50.
Okay, so 50.
It features
a
design
that
provides.
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah,
because,
so do
I mean, I would assume that they would design it for that because that's where the industry is going.
Right.
But I don't know if they can accommodate that with diffraction and chromatic aberration. It's a really wide angle lens. And so if they can pull this off, and again, I haven't had my hands on it. Nobody that has pushed the limits of the lens has had their hands on it. But will it perform? I think it will. The Art moniker from Sigma has pedigree now. It has survived trials and tests in
for
every
sure.
other lens they have put out. And it's more affordable than the alternatives. Mm-hmm. It's expensive, but it's not the most expensive. It is the best value if you want the best.
Well, the warranty is fantastic. You've got 7 years compared to Canon's 1 year. The service is top-notch from Gentech. As you say, they're the distributor for Sigma here in Canada. So they are the ones representing the service end of things. And it's funny because it's actually, they say it's a rugged and dust and splash proof design, which is exactly what you were talking about before, about how you treat your MDE65. It gets wet and so on, but this is literally built for that kind of a thing. If you're out doing the morning dew or any of that kind of stuff.
You know what? I have misused my Canon 24-105 a number of times. It has been destroyed. In fact, I don't even use it anymore because half of the frame is softer than the other half. I know a lens is out of alignment somewhere.
Wow.
But I had sent it back for service to Canon a number of times. The first time was because it just stopped working. It gave lens communication errors at anything other than 24 millimeters after about 3 years of constant use. And this is a known issue. And that shocked me because Canon will not service it for free. There is a ribbon cable that connects the aperture assembly to the lens mount as it zooms in and out. And at some point, it pinches. And after constant use of about 3 or 4 years, that breaks that ribbon cable. Huh. And you can't just replace that ribbon cable, of course. You have to replace the entire aperture assembly. So I had to do that. When it broke, I was in Istanbul. My wife and I were in the Blue Mosque. I remember this very specifically. And I took this lens, the 24-105, as an all-around, walk-around, perfect lens for travel. And it was exactly that until it broke. The other lenses in my bag, my MPE 65 millimeter macro lens and my 15 millimeter fisheye lens. I mean, I was covering the extremes with those two and everything else with the 24 to 105 and it broke. And I realized that I could get it to work again if I left it at 24 millimeter. I dialed in the aperture on my camera that I wanted it to be. I pressed the depth of field preview button on the camera, held that down while I slightly dismounted the lens, which would lock the aperture blades in place, but prevent communication to the lens, and then adjust the focus and focal length manually, and then take a shot. And I had to do that for a week and a half.
Ah, the joys.
I was not happy.
And we've talked about this before, and I always marvel at the fact that you have to know your equipment, and you know your equipment. Most people in that scenario would be like, oh, my camera is toast. Chuck in the back of the car and never shoot another photo. But Don's like, no, no, no. If I do this and hold the field preview button, that's cool.
Yeah, and it worked. But then I had it repaired. Okay, it cost me $200-something. 4 years later, it broke again. The exact same problem. The replacement part that they put in the lens didn't even fix the original issue. So, yeah. I mean, I love my Canon camera. I dislike their customer support in certain areas. And maybe this is why I will never become a Canon explorer of light, because I'm honest. I tell the truth about the gear that I use, and it broke, and it should have been fixed under warranty, even beyond the warranty period, like a recall.
See, that's
sort of
a whole topic for a whole show, though, if you think about it. Are manufacturers owning up to what they need to do? Like Gentech, there's never been an issue I've known for somebody who owns a Sigma lens that you couldn't just take it to Gentech in Markham and you're taken care of. They're that
okay,
good.
Brian, I'm going to give you one.
Thank you.
It had a good ending, though. My uncle has a Sigma 150 to 500 and beautiful lens. And he complained to me at one point recently that it was rattling around. Like, a lens should not have a rattling sound to it. And so he sent it to me because I figured I could have some sway with Gentech. I've talked to the people there before. And they said, you know, this is impossible. The floating elements that have the image stabilizer, they have three control arms. They've all broken.
Oh, what? Oh, my.
And there's no way that could happen without impact damage. And so we're not going to repair this under warranty. And I said, show me the impact damage. The lens was flawless. It was a beautiful lens. There was no impact damage on it whatsoever. So they fixed it. But on the first flush, if I didn't put up a fuss about it, they weren't going to fix it.
Okay. I mean, obviously, but a technician looks at something.
It was
a
weird scenario.
Call.
It was definitely an outlier. And when they said, okay, well, an impact damage that would cause this would clearly damage the lens somewhere outside of the, on the casing or the shell. And there was nothing. It was flawless. So they fixed
and
it.
And I think the moral of the story is they ended up fixing it, which is awesome. I don't know. There's always good and bad stories. For me, the bad far outweighs the good with these guys, including a story about my colleague who passed away and his family wanted to put his ashes in a lens. So I contacted my contact at Gentech and they shipped me a 150 to 500. They gutted it, gave me a base for it and said, here, use this. And this is now the current resting place of my colleagues or my former colleagues' ashes. I mean, they're just a great company. But that being said, you don't know how this lens is yet. Like we got to try this guy out.
Well,
I'm excited to try.
I'm excited to get my hands on one.
I've used the 12 to 24. I found it to be pretty heavy. It's an F4. It doesn't quite give you that aperture control for the night sky photos like you're talking about. So, I mean, yeah, the 14-24, you lose 2 millimeters on the wide angle, but 14 on a full frame is really wide.
14 f/2.8, that is an Astro lens and it has to perform as one. I hope so anyhow. I mean, it is architecture, it is real estate, it has a lot of purposes, but for me, I'm all about nature. And so if it can do that, then this is a lens that will be in my camera bag.
This should be out by September, I would assume.
I hope so.
If it is, then I'll probably have it for my island overnight up in North Bay.
So I'm coming.
That
I
would
will be
awesome.
There.
Actually, Don, that would be phenomenal if you were on that trip, but we'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, we'll talk about that afterwards. But anyhow, let's move on to the final segment of this chat, where we share our picks of the week. Now, cool. I typically go first, but I'm going to turn the tables on you, Brian. Let you go first and see what you have in store for us.
I'm doomed. Okay, my first thought when you asked me for a pick of the week is the Loom Cube. I love the Loom Cube, how flexible and what you can do with it. But
yep.
I also thought that I used it a lot for light painting, and my light painting stuff is pretty cool. So I was going to talk to you about light painting brushes equipment. Have you heard of light painting brushes?
Absolutely. I saw them in your studio.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So light painting brushes, there's their logo there for all of you who might know about them, are utensils that you can use for doing all kinds of cool light painting. There are light painters out there with far better images than me, and I haven't had the chance and the, I guess you could say, the opportunity or the time yet to make that epic photo that I really want to make. I hate using epic in that way because it's not appropriate. But anyway, making those photos that are just like mind-blowing, where you have ghosts and all these cool things. I tried the latest brown box video that we did for my YouTube channel. My brown box photo item that I had to use was a Ouija board. So I thought, if I could do light painting, ghosts, and all this kind of stuff in the photo, that'd be awesome. So I sat there for 2-3 hours trying this. It's the brain part of the photography that failed me on this one. So I didn't do as well as I thought, but it's not because of the tool. So here's what these things do. You attach it to your flashlight, and I had my torch handy. Here it is. So this is a EGTAC 1200 lumen flashlight, and you get these universal adapters, just rubber pieces, right?
Yep.
You put your flashlight on one side, and you use these light painting brushes, tools, in all kinds of different ways. So,
well, they had one of those fiber optic clusters that I was really curious about exploring myself. Which you have right there. That's great.
There's two versions, actually. There's the clear one that you see here, and then there's the black one. And the black one is my absolute favorite of all time. You could do so much once you can get out of the package. Ooh, there we go. Let's put that over there and put that over there. So here is the black guy. Now, the tips of it are lit up. So if I put this in the universal adapter and I lit that up, you see that there's no light coming out the sides, but it's all coming out the tips.
Yep.
So you could use that in so many ways. You can drag it and draw, create lines. You can put your face in it and like outline your face.
No, no. I'm going to do with this, Brian, when I get my hands on one of these, is I'm going to build a colored filter that sits between the flashlight and the little adapter, maybe right in there, and will give me a random rainbow effect. How hard I try to control will be different every time, and that is fun.
I'm anxious to see what you do with that. That's really cool. And if you did that with the clear one, then that glowing light would be coming out of all the sides and everything.
It would. I could play with both.
Yeah.
So where do you get this and what does it cost?
Okay, so they're not inexpensive, but I've gone through the alternative where I had the stuff. So the way this all started for me was, you know, those fiber optic things that you get, you put the little triangle base underneath it. It just changes colors and it just kind of looks like a glowing
tree. My great grandmother had one well into her 90s. It was her favorite trinket.
It's a lot of fun. A lot of kids have them when the wind blows. It just kind of changes color. So I first started off with one of those I bought at Canadian Tire for $10. I pulled the fiber optic piece out and it was like a core that I was able to then modify and put on the front of a flashlight. And that's how I first started doing light painting, was with these $10 things. So the plus side is they're $10. The downside is the filaments fall out. It falls apart. They're very weak. They're made in China, horrible build quality, and not really easy to modify to flashlights. I ended up having to use all kinds of gaff tape and all kinds of different things and modify these things. So when I found out about light painting brushes, my first experience was, okay, 3 of these rubber pieces for $50. That's a lot of money for a rubber piece. So I started making my own. I used to do home brew, so I actually had a top of one of those old bottles. I can't find that in my kit right here, but basically it looked like this, like a bottle, right? And I cut the top off, and then I ended up using that as my universal adapter. Okay, fine. It worked okay, but it kept falling apart and being loose on a flashlight. Not great. The first time I started using these, pop it on, take your flashlight, pop it in, and it's secure and it's working perfectly. So the fit and finish right away went through the roof. Easy to use, easy to work with. But better than that, when you start getting into the accessories, like the tubes that they have, they're all color-coded. So you can tell exactly which one you're using. And the only problem is when you're shooting at night and you're using a red light, you can't tell what's what. So you always have to have like a little white flashlight or something to tell the color. But these are really cool tubes, and you can just basically draw with them. When your flashlight's connected, again, use the quick release system. Put that in there. The whole thing lights up the color of the base. Really hard to tell with this webcam. You're not going to see that that's really red. But if I did the same with the blue, it shines blue and yellow.
I can see a bit of a difference. But the point is, you supply the light source.
You supply your own torch.
And they supply the modifier. That's right. And this creates the effect that you're after. This is a really cool effect.
It's really cool. And then it goes beyond that. You have the little light writers of all the different colors. You have the clear ones. So you know in those light painting photos when there's like this little starburst of light, this one little pin of bing light? That's these clear writers. It's not easy to see in the package. So you just put that on the universal adapter. Again, where did I put mine? Here it is. Universal adapter. Put your thing in there. And it just glows that color. Put it on a small aperture. Blink that for a quick second. And that really messed up my webcam. But it ends up being this little bing of light. Now, in my Ouija board photo, these were really helpful. I was able to create these little spirits up in the sky. Made it really interesting to look at. And then, of course, they have the really interesting stuff, the acrylic blades.
Oh, that is cool.
And when you start moving these around and you start making like the light passing through the edge and you still
it's almost like refractography where you're trying to play with light that is bending across an object, a wine glass or a pool of water. But this is something that you're controlling with your hand.
You got it. And you get the really neat effect of the light. Now that's on a really high power. Let's just turn that down there. So you can really create some neat effects. And just the way you move it, you can create wings coming off of people. You can do so many cool things. And, you know, they're just so flexible. And here's another cool thing. I actually was teaching at McMichael Art Gallery and a bunch of younger kids. And we were doing light painting with the younger kids. And one of them tried taking this out. And as soon as I got this, this piece broke off right here.
Oh, no.
I messaged Light Painting Brushers. They sent me another one the next day.
Perfect.
So their service is great. The product is really, really, really well built. I know that sounded not, but I mean, a little kid taking it and doing this, things can break.
Oh, trust me. I know how things break when my daughter tries to get a hold of anything.
Yes, you are now in that world, aren't you?
Oh, yes.
So I love the Light Painting Brushes stuff, but it's not inexpensive. As I mentioned, three of these for $50. I don't remember exactly the price of each individual piece, but if you want to order any of it, I've actually got a discount code.
Oh, cool.
20% off if you just put in the discount code Daytripper. I don't know if that's ever going to focus.
Perfect. Daytripper.
Daytripper. Yep. So go to Light Painting Brushes. Just type that in anywhere. It'll go straight to their website. And if you put in the code Daytripper, then you get 20% off, which is really good. They ship very quickly. And like I've been using this stuff for a while now, and
it is pregnant with possibilities. I mean, it is limited by you
exactly. And that's the hard part, because as much as I love to think of myself as the world's best photographer, Don, you and I both know otherwise. My limitations are all up here. And if you have that skill, which is why I think Daytripper works so well, is I realize my place in the industry. I will show you what you can do. I will give you the tools to make amazing images. But your own creativity has to take over, and you use these tools to your own advantage. And that's what I love about photography. When you can see somebody take a concept and just make this amazing image from it, love that. That's the coolest thing.
Well, and talking about making images, especially at the extremes where your creativity and everything kind of collide, I have this little kit. This is the Mitakon 20mm 4 to 4.5x macro lens. And this is my pick for the week.
That's neat.
This is about $200. And it is a 4.5x macro lens, which is pretty cool. I mean, at that price point, I don't think there's anything else that compares.
What does that connect to? What does that mount on?
Well, mine is Canon, but they mount that onto Nikon or Pentax or Sigma or anybody else. And so you get that for any mount that you want. And this is a F2 lens, but F2 is a bit of a misnomer because F2 plus the effective aperture equations make it maybe F8 or so, depending on the lens. But this is a fun and easy to use macro lens. The aperture is manual. It's a trigonal aperture, which is really weird. If I close down. It looks like a triangle there. It only has three blades.
That's interesting.
That is weird. I mean, okay, so why would they put a barrel here on this lens that goes from 4x to 4.5x? That is engineering challenge, and it doesn't equate to a whole lot of value. But they give me a three-blade aperture. I would have spent the money on the aperture and made it a fixed magnification factor. That's just me.
Now, the reason that you say that
still works
is
well.
The visual of the blurred back area?
The bokeh is weird triangles. Huh. If you can get the right scene, maybe that's interesting. Maybe that's valuable to you. But it's weird.
So where have you used this already?
I shot some snowflakes with it last year, and it worked really well. It did not work as well as my Canon MPE 65mm lens. But it is a fraction of the price, and Nikon doesn't have that lens. Neither does Sony. But this is available on every platform.
How much
platform.
Is this?
$200 US.
Oh, okay.
Of course, it's manual focus. There's manual everything on it. But it performs really well. I'm happy with it. I can't say it's as good as it could be. But for $200... I think that's about as best value as you can get out of something.
So you have to order that online.
Yes.
I've never seen that in Henry's or at Vistech or.
No, you have the links in the show notes to find that. But it is an online only kind of purchase right from China, you know, free shipping from Hong Kong kind of deal. You'll be happy with it. If you want to explore extreme macro photography, this will be the lens to let you do it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So with that in mind, we have to sign off very soon. My voice is fading. I have been sick for a few days, and I'm sorry if you've been suffering through this as you've been listening. It is getting worse and worse as the conversation goes on.
Oh, no. Poor Don.
Poor me. Overworked and underpaid as it is. But Brian, what
have you noticed? Have you noticed you're getting sick more often now that you have a baby?
Yes, because she brings every germ back from daycare.
Your baby brings the germs to the yard. I'm telling you.
Oh, it is great.
sorry.
So, Brian, what is the next big thing that is on the horizon for you?
You know what's funny? I know that you were going to ask me that, and I made a list because it's like every other day there's another big thing that I've got coming up right now. Teaching at Richmond Hill Schools, Barry Wrestling, this big shoot that I'm going to be doing for Barry Wrestling on March 3rd. I think the biggest thing that I'm excited about right now coming up is our YouTube channel. I'm just so excited about the Day Tripper Photo YouTube show, shows, I guess you could say, whether it's the Brown Box Challenge. The next one, we have four boxes from Nikon sitting at my studio waiting for us to open. Do you know about the Brown Box Challenge?
I do. I almost participated in one.
Ah, well, you're going to participate in one. I'm telling you right now. Essentially, we get four boxes from somebody. We don't know what's inside each. We open them up. We videotape the whole process. And whatever's inside, we make a photo with. And we've done Fuji so far. We've had some, you know, from Martin. The latest one was with the Ouija board was Lindsay, our store manager at Henry's. Her kids, a 10 and a 12-year-old, filled the boxes for us. So it's just fun. And I'm loving doing that. We're doing DigiKnows little tutorials. We're doing Patrick Versus, which are like little challenges that Patrick will challenge somebody. And what's in your bags, all these little fun videos. But the reason I'm enjoying it so much is I've not done video much. So I'm learning how to shoot video. I'm learning how to tell a story in video. I'm learning by teaching. And that to me is the most exciting thing. So I think that's what I'm going to go with. The YouTube channel. Check it out, guys. Day Tripper Photo on YouTube.
And that will be in the show notes. We have a link to all of your presences online.
Thank you.
And you mentioned video. I've got a project that I just got a green light on for the audio for it anyhow, that was originally licensed by BBC. And BBC had, I think it was an 18-month exclusivity. And so that expired on January 25th. So now that is available for me to use some freezing soap bubble footage.
I know that footage you're talking about. That's amazing.
And that will be in a small 2 or 3 minute video that will come out in the next week, I hope. So look forward to that. I am putting the final touches on it, making it work. Let's do it. Let's say, okay, well, whenever you've been listening to this show, hopefully it's not been live because I'm going to say get out and shoot. But if you've been watching live, you should probably go to bed and then go and shoot the next day. But at that time, have a great night. Enjoy the show. Oh, I hope you enjoyed the show. And take care, everybody. All the best.